Ms. Mathias, good morning to you. You may approach, but let's give everybody a moment to get in and out of the courtroom. And Mr. Ralph, also good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Then, Ms. Mathias, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice Heviken. Justices, good morning. My name's Renee Mathias. I'm an attorney at Berry Law, and I represent the appellant, Jacob Dolinar. Brief procedurally, how we got here in November of 2021, and information charging my client with two counts of possession with intent to distribute and one count of prohibited acts. And that information was filed on November 16th, 2021. November 2nd, 2021, prior to the information being filed, the state initiated a forfeiture proceeding against my client regarding the monies that were acquiesced during the traffic stop. A plea and bar was filed after multiple proceedings, and the trial court did overrule the plea and bar. I would first like to address the main argument that the state made as it relates to my client regarding standing to challenge because he did not participate in the forfeiture proceedings. There are two main arguments that the government made. One, he did not participate in the proceedings, and second, he did not at any time claim ownership of the monies that were pursuant to the forfeiture action under 28431.
Did the forfeiture action even allege that he was an owner?
Your Honor, if you look at Exhibit 1, it does, it's the state of Nebraska versus the money, and at the end of the complaint, he is deemed as an interested party in the currency. So fast forward to 2002, I look at this court's decision in Bishop that even though the previous decisions in Franco and in Spots, both of the, in those cases, the defendants participated in the forfeiture action, the court did not deem that dispositive in requiring participation in the forfeiture action.
So here's what we said, I beg your pardon, in Bishop, if I'm correct. Although numerous courts have addressed similar issues, the state has not furnished, nor has our research disclosed, any authority in support of the state's argument that jeopardy does not attach in an uncontested forfeiture proceeding that is criminal in nature. So is that the difference between Bishop and Franco on that line?
I would say that is correct, Your Honor. Okay. And I would note the court to all of the case law that the government proceeded to address that you didn't have to participate in the forfeiture actions all predated this court's decision in Bishop.
And all of, that's all of that, however, is before the LB 1106.
Correct. And LB 1106 did not, in the amendments, did not, one of the things that it did not address was the fact that an individual has to participate in the forfeiture actions. Many times, because they have 10 days to commence the forfeiture actions, clients are incarcerated, many times do not have counsel of record at that time. Specifically in this case, I wasn't his attorney until the forfeiture proceeding had been concluded.
And is Bishop still good law after LB 1106?
I would absolutely agree that it is still good law because nothing in LB 1106 changed the requirement that defendants have to participate in the forfeiture action.
Isn't the Bishop situation slightly different than the situation we have here? Because in the Bishop case, the state alleged that the Mr. or Mrs. Bishop, I'm not sure which it was an actual owner of the property?
I would say yes and no. The only way that you are going to, I would still say under, the only difference in Bishop and versus Dolinar is literally the placement of where you have the interested party. In Bishop, it is in the caption and says state of Nebraska versus the currency, and they are interested parties. In Exhibit 1, it specifically states that state of Nebraska versus the $12,865 in currency. And at the bottom, person with interest in the subject currency are Jacob Edward Dolinar. So I would say that persons with interest in the subject currency is analogous to an interested party.
Are Franco and Spot still good law after the statutory amendments?
I would agree. So
well, that was a question.
So yes, I do believe that they are still good law, because if you look at Franco started the framework that deemed 28431 is criminal in nature and subject to double jeopardy.
And why? What was the basis?
For Franco, for the purposes of the usury test, they basically stated three reasons. One, 28431 is simply, it's in the criminal code under crimes and punishment. The second is 28431 required proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And I anticipate that that is going to be a question that this court is going to ask. But then also, the court had historically treated 48431 as criminal in nature prior to that. So looking at the totality of that, absolutely 28431 was in criminal in nature.
So your argument is, at least impliedly, that the legislature somehow intended to change the law and it reduced the burden of proof, but did not intend to make the proceeding civil in nature.
I agree. I believe that the reason that they reduced the burden of proof was to keep it consistent with the burden of proof contained in 28416, subsection 18. The burden of proof under that section is clear and convincing evidence as well.
Did the introducer statement to LB 1106 establish that forfeiture is not a separate criminal proceeding which will result in defendants being subject to double jeopardy?
I believe that was started as the intent, but also the intent was to change civil forfeiture proceedings into the criminal forfeiture proceedings. And that's why they outlined a very rigid process that you have to go through under 28416 if you want to seek both a criminal conviction and a civil forfeiture. And that's where I believe Spots laid the framework on how to do that. If you don't want the federal government having to forfeit money in order to proceed with a state conviction, 28416 allows that to happen, and Spots kind of set the framework, continued that 28431 was criminal in nature, but I'm going to give you an avenue on how to do it, and you have to do it under one single proceeding.
Do you, 28431 seems to talk in terms that are mandatory. It says that law enforcement shall seize and the prosecutors shall file within 10 days, and everything is in terms of shall.
And I believe...
And doesn't that mean that it would be practically impossible in terms of double jeopardy to ever be able to prosecute on the criminal side, because law enforcement and prosecutors have to proceed under 431.
The way I interpret it, Your Honor, is you have, if you want to seek forfeiture, you have two options. If you just want to seek forfeiture, you can proceed under 28431, and that gives you the avenue to do that. But
what do you make of the language that says shall be seized, shall file within 10 days?
If they are truly just wanting to seek a forfeiture, but if you're wanting to seek a forfeiture and a conviction, then you have to go under 28416.
So 431 is optional.
In my interpretation, if you are wanting, necessarily, if you are wanting a criminal conviction and a forfeiture, then you cannot proceed under 28431. Because in looking at the legislative intent And looking at the additional steps that 28416 presents, why would any prosecutor, I'm a former prosecutor, why would any prosecutor go through all of those extra steps to go under 28416? They would just go and file the forfeiture under 28431.
If that was their only objective. Go under 431 if your objective is just limited to the money.
And exactly. And so I don't...
So how do we reconcile that with 416, where forfeiture is rolled up into arguably a criminal event?
And that is where I believe they're still both criminal in nature. It's if you just... You have a case where they seek $200,000 in a car, but as a prosecutor, you don't have enough information to go under a criminal conviction, then you can proceed under 28431. In my opinion, I don't believe that the legislature was wrong in not repealing 28431. I think it gives the county attorney two avenues in assessing a case. If you want both, if you want the criminal conviction and the forfeiture, you go under 28416 subsection 18. If you look at a case, you analyze a case, and you don't think you can get a conviction, but you want to go after the, if you want to proceed in forfeiture proceedings, you go under 28431.
And that's criminal?
In my opinion, it still meets the criminal in nature.
What's the burden of proof in 431?
The same as 28416, clear and convincing evidence.
Can you have a constitutional burden less than beyond a reasonable doubt in a proceeding that's criminal in nature?
Absolutely, because I think they're doing it. I mean, there's no doubt that 28416 subsection 18 is criminal in nature. You have a criminal prosecution that you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And as part of that same proceeding,
a standalone procedure with a burden of proof that is less than beyond a reasonable doubt, and we would conclude it's criminal in nature. Wouldn't that pose constitutional problems?
I don't believe so, because if you look at the totality and you look at the analysis of Franco, Franco didn't cite the only reason that beyond a reasonable doubt was one of the factors in deeming it criminal.
But the landscape has changed.
It has.
Franco.
It has, but the concern is there would be no incentive to if this court deemed that 28431 is not criminal in nature, every prosecutor, as one myself, I would never go under 28416. I'm going to continue to do a parallel prosecution, and I believe that that's absolutely against what the legislative intent was.
How can you tell what the legislative intent was? I mean, I've read that. Help me understand what you tease out of it.
Okay. I tease that the legislative intent was to give two options. That one option is if you want a criminal conviction and a forfeiture, you have to do it per spots under one single proceeding, and therefore jeopardy does not attach because you are doing it. It has to be filed in one proceeding. If you still want the forfeiture and want to go down that route and you do not believe that you can make a criminal conviction, then you go under 28431.
I understand that's the interpretation you're wishing us to adopt, but what in the legislative history are you basing that upon?
The only thing that they did to 28431 was change the standard of proof to mirror 28416. And so in my opinion, they did not repeal 28431. They made a process under 28416 that is significantly more difficult for the prosecution to obtain a criminal conviction and a forfeiture, that they have to go through significantly more steps than 28431. And if you look at the original intent, was to have more uniformity and to protect citizens from just these outright forfeitures and then the subsequent criminal proceedings.
What additional steps does 416 require?
So 416 requires, first, you have to have a conviction. And then at that point, you have to plead a forfeiture proceeding. So you've got a criminal filing under 28416, and then you have to first get a conviction. And then after...
You first need a defendant.
Pardon me?
Do you first need a defendant under 416?
Absolutely, because you have to have somebody to prosecute.
So it's contested?
It is a contested proceeding, and you have to have a conviction, and then you have a separate hearing after the conviction. So the main difference between 28431 and 28416 is you have to have a conviction, and then after the conviction, you have a separate hearing that you prove by clear and convincing evidence whether or not it meets the forfeiture requirement. I believe I'm out of time. If there are any other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. The overarching issue here is whether the district court properly overruled Dolinar's plea and bar for several reasons, which I'll detail here shortly. We think that it did, and so we ask this court to affirm the district court's ruling. As I'm sure this court is aware, this is one of four similar forfeiture cases that I've briefed in the past couple months, each of them addressing kind of the same overarching issue, whether a district court properly overruled a plea and bar when the plea and bar was based on earlier forfeiture proceedings arising from the same incident for which the defendant is also prosecuted. Position has evolved a little bit over the course of those proceedings, but basically sort of have a multi-pronged argument. First is that undertaking the analysis, the legislative intent analysis, the change in LB 1106 in 2016, coupled with what I consider faulty reasoning in Franco, we're asking this court to overrule Franco's holding that the legislature intended 28431.
What specifically was the faulty reason in Franco?
So,
in your opinion?
Yes. As far as the intent specific portion, I think Franco largely ignored the procedural mechanisms that were in place for 28431, which, as the U.S. Supreme Court said in Ursary, is basically the biggest indicator of congressional, or in this case, legislative intent. Those mechanisms, one, it's an in rem proceeding. Historically, those are considered civil. It's an in rem being a proceeding against the property itself. That's why we have, you know, the state versus $18,000, the state versus, you know, 1987 Toyota pickup, et cetera. You have separate burdens of proof for both the defendant, or not the defendant, the claimant, individual claimants, and the state in these proceedings. You have what Your Honor emphasized. I think the 10-day requirement is pretty critical there, because as I pointed out in brief, if the prosecutor is required to seize and then within 10 days of the seizure institute these forfeiture proceedings, and they're still criminal in nature under Franco, well, that causes a lot of problems with any subsequent criminal action.
So those were features of 431 in whatever, 1999?
Yes. Right.
So we're not looking at a change in those features.
Correct.
Thank you.
And then obviously the burden of proof was beyond a reasonable doubt there, but now it's clear and convincing evidence, which I think is also indicative of a civil proceeding, particularly when the legislature is well aware of Franco, and presumably it's holding that rested in part, at least, on the beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof. So our take
is... So does the legislative history say we want to get away from Franco and Spatz?
Well, the legislative history is kind of...
We're not offended. I just want to know...
No, right. I mean, I think they were aware...
I may be the only one that was here in 1999.
I think they were aware of Franco, presumably aware of Spots. I don't know necessarily that they understood Franco fully. And so maybe, you know, what they chose to do or did not do wasn't necessarily perfectly in line with...
When we say we're trying to decipher legislative intent in this area, are we looking for some objectified intent reflected in the text, or are we trying to get in the legislators' heads?
Well, I think the clearest indicator of legislative intent is what they actually did, as opposed to what they said they wanted to do or what an individual senator said he or she wanted to do. And that's why I think, as I said in my brief, the clearest indicator is they left 431 in place and they reduced the burden of proof, which actually makes it easier to...
Also, Franco may not be that stupid. At the time, it was beyond a reasonable doubt.
True, yeah.
Right? Something happened.
Yes. Okay. And so what they actually did was make forfeiture easier to obtain, and in light of Franco, reducing the burden of proof seems to suggest to me that they intended it to be civil rather than criminal.
So in answer to Justice Pappas' question, you look at the text, and at the clues in the text.
I think so, yes.
Thank you.
And so our position is that we'd ask this court to overrule Franco's holding that the legislature intended it to be criminal, and then it becomes denominated a civil sanction. If this court agrees, then you'd go to the second prong of the ursory tests, which is basically, okay, it's denominated a civil sanction now. Is it so punitive in purpose or effect that it transforms it into a criminal sanction? You'd look at the Kennedy-Mendoza factors. There's seven of them. Not exhaustive list, but a pretty good list of factors. And then you'd have to show, the defendant would have to show by the clearest proof that the purpose or effect was so punitive that it negates the legislative intent. And we don't think
would all of this be consistent with giving a consistent with the rights of a under 431 of a named party and or a mere interested party? Does it matter? To be too simple, forgive me, right? You were looking at the forfeiture one to kind of say, was it a criminal event or not?
Right.
Okay, right. Would one of those clues be whether or not there was there was an individual named, was it the state versus a bunch of money or a thing? Or was there a named party? Or was there just a list of interested folks who might have an interim interest in it?
I don't think so, because regardless whether you have an interested party or a potential claimant or what have you, the proceeding is in rem against the property itself by the statutory language. So I don't think that would affect whether it's criminal or civil, if that answers your question.
Well, is your proposition in rem proceedings are civil and cannot be criminal?
I guess that kind of gets back to the whole ursory test, because, they said, and I think that historically this is accurate, that in rem proceedings are considered civil, generally speaking. But if there were some aspects of it that were so punitive or in purpose or effect, then they would disregard that label and say, it's a criminal sanction, we're going to treat it as such. But that gets back to the multi-factor analysis, et cetera. But generally speaking, I think if it's a proceeding against the property in rem, that's considered civil.
That's the starting point, and analytically, I think so. Proposition.
Yeah. Does ursory itself provide some guidance on that second step of the analysis?
Yes, it does. I mean, they go through many of the factors and, all of the factors basically, and conclude that it is not so punitive in purpose or effect that it renders it criminal. I think the Court of Appeals had a case unpublished, but I think it was Judge Seavers maybe, but where they say, the same analysis basically applies, but we're bound by Franco, we're bound by Spots. This is a criminal proceeding here in Nebraska. But
are there features of the forfeiture statute, the 28431, that differ from the federal forfeiture statute was an issue in ursory?
My recollection was they were pretty much, they were very similar. You had the same type of language and considerations. I don't know specifically offhand. I'd have to look at the federal statute in ursory again. But getting back to my sort of multi-tiered approach, we think that this court should overrule Franco on the holding that it's the legislature intended 431 to be criminal and actually intended it to be civil. And then if we move to the second prong of the usury test and say, okay, it's not so punitive in purpose or effect that it remains civil, well, then it's a civil sanction. It doesn't implicate double jeopardy principles.
So just to be clear, are you saying that in your advocacy that Franco was wrong when it was written, or Franco is now inconsistent with the revised legislation?
Both. I think Franco was wrong when it was written, and then that has been exacerbated by 2016.
It became more wrong.
Yeah, basically. Because of LB 1106.
If we disagree with you on the first premise but not the second, does it make any difference?
No.
You're so kind.
And then, you know, alternately, if this court were to disagree, you know, our position would basically be, well, Franco might be wrong as well on the fact that this is not the same offense. I don't think the double jeopardy analysis there was correct. And then alternately, what I said in brief, that you know, there is a lot of federal case law out there suggesting that if you don't participate in the forfeiture proceeding, then there is no former jeopardy and thus no double jeopardy. So I addressed as well State v. Bishop. I think that
what else should we overrule in view of 1106 in your view?
I think we can stick with Franco and Spots.
So. Okay, and if I may, just to narrow down this whole conversation in the last couple of minutes, is the 431 proceeding. Is that the focus, or are you also... Are you help me out. To what statutes are you referring in your most recent remarks?
Well, 431. Okay. We're suggesting right. that 431, right. the legislation, and combined again with the issues with Franco, that we need to say that the legislature intended it to be civil as right. opposed to criminal.
Right. Are you commenting on 416?
What do we have, 416 and 431?
Well, looking at the legislative history, I'm not entirely sure. There's reasons why you might proceed under 431 as opposed to 416. For example, let's say you've got a property that's forfeitable, that you have multiple property owners or alleged claimants. Well, you might not go under 416 because that's only one person's interest as opposed to, say, the five people that have interest.
Isn't
so we're going to proceed
under 431 awfully mandatory, doesn't it?
It is.
Shall.
Yes, it does. My recollection, however, is not hard line based on this court's decision, and I'm sorry I forget the name, but this court has interpreted the shall to be slightly less than, you know, mandatory. I kind of lost my train of thought there. But so there are multiple reasons, I think, Judge Funk, or multiple situations where you might decide to go under 416 versus 431. It might simply be a matter of efficiency. You know, if we only have one interested party, we're proceeding criminally. We'll just do it all in one proceeding, not have a separate criminal and a separate civil.
But under 416, you have to obtain a conviction to get forfeiture.
Yes.
Why would you take that burden on?
Well, I mean, it may not be a close case, I guess. Or, like I said, if you're confident in going forward that way, then why have a separate civil proceeding with, you know, publication notice requirements and all these other things, other potential claimants. So I guess I foresee a situation where you could, as a prosecutor, choose to go under 416 versus 431. Unless this court has further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No,
we do not. Counsel, thank you again. And arguments on Dolinar are concluded, and you are excused. The next case of the day, then, is State versus Reznicek.